And then for a while, years ago, I had a... I mean, I still have weird eating stuff, but I've just now made it weirder. But I used to overeat like anyone would. And I went to OA briefly, and they made keep a journal. So Janine, why did you eat the whole pizza? Because it's delicious! Jesus! What the fuck? This is not neuroscience. I'm not medicating anything. I'm not stuffing feelings. There is no... I was properly parented. Nobody touched me except that kid in the closet, which was a whole other issue. I wasn't related to him. It didn't... The pizza's delicious. Have you seen it? It's delicious. And it's cheese. And so you ate most of the cake? Yes. Why? Oh, my God. What? Why? Why? Why would I eat most of the cake? It's so good. And it's not that hard to do. I'm tired of this. I'm tired of these myths that we live by in this country about the you know, all men are created equal, which we technically are, but we don't adhere to it. That's what I mean by myth. Ben and Jerry's has 4 servings. That kind of foundation myth drives me nuts. It does not have 4 servings. So that's so clearly it's like a bowl. Don't have it's like. And I'm so tired of being bullied by this. It's just. Why keep a journal? It's delicious. It's just delicious, and it's no big swig at all.
But you get what I'm saying. It's like, so in one respect, I think it's comical that we're warning against calories, which really aren't the problem.
I dig it. It's making calories bad when calories aren't bad. You need fucking calories.
And if anything, the alternative, so now it says, we've lowered, you know, now you could buy the Pepsi with 0 calories. And everyone goes, that's healthy. My grandmother said, she goes to the senior center, and she said a doctor came into them and told them that they should drink more diet soda.
That's
and I was like, that doctor should have his fucking license revoked.
Right?
Because telling you, drink more aspartame. That's fucking good for you. That doctor should have his fucking license revoked.
It's like the sacraments at church, you know? It's like, if we're going to make that leap and agree that, well, I ate something that I think was the body of Christ, but it surely wasn't an unleavened piece of bread, and that we see what happened when you eat more unleavened bread instead of what might have been the original sacrament. I don't know necessarily where I'm going with that, but it's like...
No, I get it, yeah.
Yeah, it's like they replaced the real thing with a fake and told you this is actually better for you.
It's so funny because was it Coke that had the logo in the 80s, the real thing?
I think so. Absolutely. Yeah. And the new Coke thing is, I think, a really great lesson in the business of marketing, propaganda, and conspiracy. I mean, you just spend a little bit of time with what was the new Coke thing all about, and you can get an idea of the way the game was being played for a long fucking time. Because that was how they ushered in, they took out sugar and put in corn syrup.
Well, precisely, yeah.
How you can't just go, you couldn't just say, here's Coke, and then one day put corn syrup in, and people go, this shit isn't the same. What happened? And they're not going to go back to sugar. What you do is you take it away for a while, and then you give it back in a new label, classic Coke, but a different formula. And people are like, they gave it back to us. See, they're on our side. They listened to us. What the fuck were they thinking? No, they duped you.
So this is interesting, because I wonder is that the, you know, Jan Urban psychedelics thing, right? Oh, you know, we're going to take it away for a little while, and then, we're going to legalize it for you. You know, we're going to tax it and control it and give you the genetically modified strain, but...
It's pretty good. I like that.
But I don't know. It's fascinating to me because So where I was going with this is I just saw yesterday Pepsi actually has advertising because in here saying so here in New York City they limited the size of sodas, so they made them make all the soda bottles and cans smaller. So I think a 12-ounce can is now like a 10-ounce can, and a 20-ounce bottle is now like a 14-ounce bottle. Or I don't even fucking know. I haven't drank soda in years, so I really don't know. But there, I saw the again, there was different advertisements from the government and from the Beverage Association and all this stuff. Again, all advertisements saying, you know, we're giving you more choices because we care about your health. And it's funny in one respect because for the last number of years, the size of everything has been shrinking while the cost goes up. I remember being a kid who ate really unhealthy Pop-Tarts. And I remember within like 2 years, my mom brought home the same box of Pop-Tarts, and the Pop-Tarts were smaller, but the package was the same. So it's like, here's this box that's now like 50% air, and they probably raised the price $2.
Yep.
And here's half the size item. Now, whatever, I haven't eaten Pop-Tarts in years either, but my, you know, the point is that all these companies are reducing the quantity and telling you, we're doing you a favor. We're going to charge you more for less, but we're doing it because we care about your health. It's just total bullshit. But what's really funny to me, so that's one side of the conversation, is all these companies which are reducing the quantity of what they're giving you, charging you more, and pretending like it's a good thing. But then this Pepsi ad I saw yesterday is, again, it was a full person, just an outline, like a silhouette of a person, fist raised in the air. Instead of holding the cell phone, they're holding the Pepsi. And it says, don't let bureaucrats tell you what size soda to drink.
Really?
Now, it's funny because I have to say, my political feelings of it is, honestly, the government has no right to declare a 20-ounce bottle of soda illegal. I am, in one sense, I am offended by that. I don't agree with that legislation. However, we see how, again, it's the tag team of, we're going to pretend we're doing something good for you, and then tell you, you want to be an individual, don't you? You don't want to, you know, fight for your right to drink more soda. You know, it's this sort of reverse psychology of, obviously, you don't want to be told what you can and can't drink. Pepsi's telling you, we support your right to drink more of our crap.
It just seems like all the tricks and tools that they used to spring capitalism and birth it and to make it the dominant paradigm of the 20th century, that the way to end it is to use the same tricks. That, you know, and they're realizing that it's far more difficult than they ever imagined, that people really, really fucking love capitalism. Because it's a surefire way for anyone to cheat, lie, and steal their way to an identity and to wealth. And, you know, is that what we are inherently?
That's interesting. That's really interesting because, see, I think what's interesting to me, and what the sort of struggle that I've had in the last year, and I take this sort of full circle, the reason I think I've been kind of particularly hard on Kati is because I don't want that. As a guy who, once we put out the Sync book, Volume 1, and now we are selling a product, I suddenly became hyper-aware of the moral obligation that came with that. And it's this side of, well, I don't want to pretend to be a guru just to sell a few fucking books. and I became really hyper aware of it. But then there's other people, I've been criticized, people saying, no, to sell a book with about sync, you're a capitalist, you're just trying to profit off people. So it's really interesting to me because what I see is the wrong, in my estimation, just as the guys from the last year or two, is almost the wrong thing being demonized. If I put hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of work into making a book that people could enjoy, making a website, doing these podcasts, doing all the back stuff, and asking for, hey, can a little compensation come my way just so I can eat? There are people demonizing that, saying, oh, you're just trying to market synchromysticism, you know, you have that capitalist mindset of whatever. I'm saying, no, I think if you put in a tremendous amount of time into things people enjoy, there should be some compensation for that, I don't think is a bad thing. However, I think it comes with a great moral responsibility, and how poetic that we're having this conversation. I just saw Sybil put online that Peter Parker is dying. They're killing off Peter Parker in the comics. So this idea of with great power comes great responsibility, I guess no more. Now we just have great power unchecked. But I feel like there's an immense responsibility that comes with that. Is it was only at the moment that I started doing more interviews, started having more of a presence of trying to, you know, get this book out there, that I realized, oh shit, I have to back away from the spiritual guru guy stuff completely, because I don't want to be a spiritual huckster. I don't, you know, and it's not saying I don't believe that there is a valuable tool within synchromysticism. It's just like, again, it's like I'm really struggling to find that balance. And that's why I felt I had to back away from that end of things, is saying, well, here I am, I've put in all this work, and I feel I need some compensation for it, and that's where I need to focus right now. And it doesn't mean that I become a huckster. It means maybe find other ways to supplement my income, or maybe I have to, I basically have stopped blogging at this point, you know, just cut back on certain things that I do. But the other thing that I felt I had to be cut back on, and it was really good, I'm glad, is like, there's this natural temptation, and I think that's probably the temptation that Jake had to face, why I'd like to speak to him, is there was a point where he was doing, you know, a lot of Red Ice interviews, different interviews, and had this following, and people saying, you have some sort of answer, and that's, you have to really continue to check yourself in that place. Because I've done interviews where people say, so what does this mean? And I say, well, I don't know what that means. We're trying to figure out. And people go, no, but come on, give us an answer. It's like, well, all right, this is what seems to work for me. And then very quickly, oh. And it's just how an interview sort of works, I think, for a lot of these interviews. But it's like, no, stop that. I don't want to be, you know, I didn't come on here to sell you a spiritual practice. I didn't even come on here to sell you a book. I just want to, can we just talk about these things?
Yeah, can we share ideas? I might know something that is of value to you. You might have something that is of value to me. And are we moving the conversation forward? I think if you ask anyone, does Sync Book Volume 1 and Sync Book Volume 2, has that retarded and stifled the conversation? And if anyone perceives that that is a yes, then I would like to hear them back that up. But if, you know, just as Jake's brilliant coining of the word synchromysticism, it gave people something to hold on to, you know, it gave it some substance. And then you took it the next logical step and brought it into the real world via a book. It's an incredibly valuable step in the process, in the education of people who are, you know, on the edges, on the fringes, and want a doorway into, you know, the room. And that's all it is. And if people are going to attack Alan Green because of a book that has a price tag on it, well, you're not attacking Alan Green. You've got a much bigger enemy to fight. Alan Green is not the problem. The Sync Book 1 and the Sync Book 2 is not the problem. You've got issues with something entirely different. This is an incredibly valuable gift to... It goes down to cliches, ultimately, sometimes, where it's like, if just one person finds that book in a terrible situation, then you have done a valuable service to humanity. It really is that simple.
I thank you very much for saying so, but I also have to thank you. I mean, basically, this show has become my sort of catharsis and grounding, because for a while I was sort of a little bit lost at sea of trying to find that balance and just saying, I want to explore ideas, but it's like if I go on a... So if I get interviewed to talk about the Sync Book, what I found the challenge was is how do I say, well, here's 26 authors, and they all have a different point of view, and I'd like to and I'm here to discuss those points of view. And how do I either bite my tongue if it's something I disagree with, or do I have a caveat to that and say, well, I don't agree with this, but this is what they think, and just became this sort of tightrope walk. And then was the idea of, now suddenly I felt like I was in a position where for me to say, hey, I'd like to challenge something Jake says, or I'd like to challenge something Warren Coleman says, or I don't know, I'm just pulling names out of my ass. To say that, it becomes almost like I feel like kind of a shithead because, well, hey, you asked them to be in this book, how can you say, well, yes, they're in this book, but I don't agree with their position. But to me, it's like that's the honest thing to say is, this, please, I'm putting them in the book because I think they have a point of view that should be looked at, and it's very valuable in a sense, but there are things I disagree with within it. And then it was like this idea of like, well, then maybe I should just keep my personal thing out of it. Okay, so I could just say, hey, this guy believes this. And just try and do my best to speak their line and say, check out this. This is what they think. This is what the other guy thinks. This is what the other guy thinks. But then I guess the sort of nervousness came in is, I don't want to sell someone else's line, especially if I don't agree with it. So it just, I felt, there was a moment where I felt like I was in a really hard position. And I also felt like it sort of kept me from the playground a little bit of, I want to be able to discuss these things, but now I'm in a position where I almost have to be the caretaker for, at this point, 52 points of view. How do I stay objective and still be part of the conversation where I get to disagree with things? And I do feel successful to an extent that I was able to find that tightrope, but it was not easy. And I guess where I'm trying to go with this is, I thank this show, because here the format is such where it's not me coming on to bring a certain something. This is a place where we can disagree, where we can discuss, explore. I think more often than not, the reason why our shows are so long is because we're just, this is the process of exploring and during the conversation. And it just really helped ground me, or at least like this was my sort of sanctuary space, where it's like, all right, on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I got to be Sync Pimp, and then come Thursday, I can be Alan again.
Take off the Sync Pimp hat and have a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, this show, this year and these hours of shows that we've done, I think are the roots of something that is emergent. And what will break through the surface, we don't even know yet. But I think in time we can look back to this year, 2012, and these shows, and it'll all be in there. Everything will just, at some point, will have been touched upon, and it's going to be a fascinating document for what's to come. I think that you and I both realize that this show, the sync books, the blogs, the videos, they are not the final product. These are the first steps, and what the goal is to produce what is known as art. And really, when I use that term sync tank, is that's what this is. Anyone is invited to share ideas, to disagree, to leave angry or upset, but it is a valuable forum. This is what the internet was created for. This is the point of the thing itself. It's not for us to remain inside these little squares that touch. It's to break out of them. These are cells that are, you know, these are the cells of culture, you know, where we're germinating the ideas that will birth the art of the future. I really think so. I really think that 50 years from now, when you're an old man, you might meet somebody or you might see somebody's work of art and they'll say, I listened to this show back in the day. Alan Green, he put out this book. And you'll know that that will be the proof of what this is. I just think everyone is just so, their attention span is so fucked, and their interests are used to being met so quickly that they've forgotten that the good stuff takes years and years and years to develop. To create any of the things that stand the test of time takes years to develop. I think that's why we love music so much, is because true artists and who create true music, there's really nothing like a good musician or a good album. I mean, you can go to it over and over again in many different moods and different emotions, and it enhances your understanding or your feeling. I think that's why we reject so much of the crap that is pop, because it is disposable. It is corn syrup. It hits your tongue, it turns on the light, and then it has dire consequences the day after. And ultimately, it is shit, because the shit hasn't been refined. So for anyone to look upon Sync Book as something in the same vein, they're just angry or confused or upset. And they're lashing out for attention. They're not lashing out at the real problem. It's a really sad statement if they can't see that, I believe. And I'm willing to be proven wrong. I think time will, like always, it is the ultimate judge and jury of these things. But I have a good feeling about involving myself in what it is that we're doing here. I mean, there's so many fucking things in this world that are traps and that promise things that aren't real. But we don't promise shit with this stuff. We don't even know where it's going. We don't even know if it's good or not, but we keep doing it. The fact that it's still going is its only proof of its merit right now. I don't know. I guess that's enough enough politicking for this show, but I really believe in it. And I really believe that, you know, if I do have a beef with any of the authors in the Sync Book, that I would hope that if they have spent the time truly developing their ideas, that they can step into this chat room and record a couple of hours and we'll get to the bottom with it. And if at the end I say, you know what, I was completely wrong, I'll be the happiest man in the room. You know, I would love to be proven wrong. Because then it gives me hope.
Yeah, exactly. This is, I do feel like we are doing something really valuable. I mean, I think it's funny because I think there were two approaches I had to writing my my sort of forward to Sync Book 2. And one was to say, hey, to ensure that we don't become a cult or we're not, you know, ruling out other perspectives, it's really important for me to put in opposing viewpoints, to keep this a mixed bag, not to muddy the waters, although I love Muddy Waters the musician, but not the, not in the, like, CIA, intelligence operatives sort of way of, like, oh, you know, keep those waters muddy so that people can't figure out what's going on. I'm not trying to cause confusion, but to say, I don't think we have the answer. I'm not even sure there is an answer. I think there are probably multiple answers. Everyone has to find what's right for them. So there's that. And that was almost how I wrote it. But the other thing that I also had to admit is that there's something I feel compelled to do this work, as much as it requires me to do a little, sometimes I feel like I have to do a little maneuvering to kind of check myself, just ego checking, make sure I'm not bashing people, make sure we're not, we're not a fucking cult or all the different things that I'm sort of have in the back of my mind. Those are minor compared to this compulsion to feel like we are doing something valuable. And Jake has a huge role in that. And every one of these 52 people have a huge role in that. That I think that this is an expression of our time. You know, I love Doug constantly asks the question. He doesn't anymore, but in 42 minutes, he used to always ask, you know, what does this say about our current zeitgeist? And people always didn't know how to answer that question. And I think I tried asking that question once to, I think it might have been when we had Freeman on or something. And no one has an answer to that question because that's a really hard question. But I think ultimately, that's what we're doing, is by examining the flow and the various tributaries and so on, we're kind of figuring out what the zeitgeist is, which is very hard, I think, for cultures usually have to look back 20 years later. You made the point last week, I think, with the time wave zero. You said, in 20 years, 40 years, you might look back and say, yeah, 2012 was the point it all changed. But it's really hard to notice while you're in the middle of it.
Yeah, time is definitely the water that we swim in. And, just like a fish, experiences water, we are most of the time, that's how we're experiencing our moments.
Just think back to being a kid. You would, you don't realize yourself getting taller, and you're like, you kids get measured, and it's like, oh, it was not, I only grew half an inch, or, whatever. And, this, you can't really see it while you're in it. And then I have this experience all the time. I see my niece fairly regularly, but if I don't see her for like a month, and I see my niece, and I'm like, oh my God, this kid got so big in a month. To the child, it probably doesn't feel that way. I remember being a child, and it didn't feel that way.
Right, exactly.
So we don't realize how much we're growing while we're in the thing itself. To go back to that, yeah, we're in the thing itself, and I think right now we're in the process of trying to examine the thing itself, and it's proving a little tricky, but also, I think, highly valuable.
You know, in 1945, right, was the first nuclear testing, the Trinity. And its nickname was The Gadget.
Yes, right? Yeah.
And, 67 years later in 2012, Time Magazine's Gadget of the Year is the iPhone 5. So the Gadget of the Year in 1945 was the nuclear bomb. 67 years later, it's the iPhone 5. And what is the iPhone 5 other than, a computer in your pocket, a wireless computer in your pocket, a wireless computer that has a battery that recharges itself and doesn't need changing for years. And if you believe that that is a sign that we have that we're under more mind control, or that the elite have more power over us, or that the world is going to hell, or it's a sign of regression, okay, make your case. But I would like to believe that if we went from, in 1945, an atomic bomb being deemed the gadget of the year, one could say, to something that provides answers and connection across the globe instantaneously, then that's got to be progress. It has to be. Because the gadget itself doesn't define itself. The user defines the gadget. And if you can't, and if in 1975 a Terence McKenna looked into his crystal mushroom ball and talked to his self-transforming machine elves and saw this optimism for the future and had this time wave, this object that seemingly was, you know, as above, so below in high definition, and seemed to want to yell and scream at him that, yes, this thing is happening. This is good. The people are getting smarter. The novelty is concressing. We are getting closer to the objects that will make the rest of time a more habitable, you know, place, that will spread peace and love and harmony, and will, you know, diffuse situations that used to be solved by atomic bombs. Yes, I think that, you know, with these smartphones in the pockets nearly in probably in every country of the globe, meaning that everyone with a connection to the internet is seemingly, you know, a second away, then I think he was onto something. I think he fucking nailed it. I think he saw and was the messenger of good fortune. And that's not to say that bad shit won't still happen, but our tools to how we deal with bad shit will be powerful and will be constructive. So when we have a school shooting like we did recently, the conversation seemingly is still going. It wasn't, oh, that's horrible, that's awful, and then you move on to your personal life and you forget about it. These tools are keeping that conversation in the forefront of our minds, and probably actions will be done to become better educated about it. And if you don't notice that happening right now, I'd like to see what it is that you are noticing. Because I don't know. The waters are getting clearer. They have to be. It might be more complex, and it might ask more of you intellectually. You might have to be smarter, but we seemingly have the tools to become smarter right in our pocket. I don't know. Maybe, you know, that cell phone with the raised hand, although it's being projected through a marketing strategy, maybe that sync wink is that, you know, it was the missing object in those old posters.
Well, it's funny, yeah, because, you know, Justin, I listened to the remainder of your show with Justin after I left. I guess that's episode 30. Yes. That third hour. And it was interesting because I actually think he had excellent points as far as that tools, again, these tools can be used to liberate or control. Everything has a sort of dualistic nature to it, and we can get stuck in dualistic thinking. And I think the transcendent point is to realize that both are true at the same time. So the technology, of course, can be used to control or liberate, and I think Justin made some excellent points there. But there also would be the idea of how many times in the last few years do we see the police beat the shit out of somebody and someone caught it on film with their cell phone. You know, or there's a protest and the police start cracking down on the protesters and people catch it on their phones. And they can put it on YouTube and everyone sees it. This has to be changing the game. And I think we're foolish to think that it doesn't.
Absolutely, so, absolutely.
So yes, they can use the cell phone in your pocket to track you, you know, the GPS in your pocket to track you and clamp down on you that way. But you can also use the camera on your phone to show them clamping down on you. And, you know, hopefully that's something that you can use as in your defense.
Well, it's that whole notion of high definition. When somebody has the cell phone video of the police brutality at a rally or a peaceful demonstration, the people now cannot fall prey to saying the police are bad. They have specific video of that man in that police uniform is bad. They can work to extract those individuals and make sure that they cannot wear that uniform, and they can see if the police department improves. So it puts the burden of condemning the specific, making the specificity accurate. Because it's so easy for a crowd to say, fuck the police. No, what if you have a camera and you show a policeman in the same footage in the background protecting somebody from another policeman? Because then you have to change your argument. All police aren't bad. So let's get down to the actual crime. Let's get down to the actual criminal. Let's identify the psychopath who was able to get the uniform and take care of that. It makes everybody accountable for their anger and what they're upset about. And it's this kind of high definition that I think solves problems. And it will be valuable. I think people need to start taking out their cell phones and capturing as many positive things that policemen do. Like when a police officer comes to your house and breaks up a fight, or catches a criminal, take a video of that. Push that out into the meme stream. Get those videos out there. Let them compete with the other videos. Let all the evidence into play. Because we do have the tools now. We just have to have the incentive to want to capture the evidence. I think people get more individually if they're able to capture a tragedy happening on their cell phone, because the attention works back to the person who caught it. They somehow become a hero because they captured the crime. Well, why can't you be a hero when you capture the good shit happening? Every time a fire department goes to a house and puts out a fire, put that on video, put that on YouTube. Flood the stream with all of the memes. Get all of the information in there. And let's actually see what it is that's happening. And
well, I will, as just again to play devil's advocate on that one, is I think if you watch, you know, Channel 4 news tonight, you're going to see firemen putting out a fire and, you know, police arrested, please, this, you know, crack dealer or whatever. You're going to see those memes are already being propagated. I think we are at the point, I mean, your point is well taken. I just want to say that I think there was a sort of lockdown on not only the information, but then how it gets presented or what information gets presented. And so ultimately, your point is well taken, that it should all be available. I think at this point, we're at a point where the policeman giving shoes to homeless man thing went viral, but there are a million people who won't share of the policeman beating the shit out of somebody. I would like to see a point where those things are. How should I say? So, yeah, you want to have all the information out there, but how do I say this? You know, a policeman, you know, stopping a bank robber, that's kind of his job. So that's like saying we should go to, you know, an accountant's office and take a video of an accountant doing someone's taxes. Maybe. But, you know, but do you know, I'm sure H&R Block is, if that guy gets someone an awesome refund, H&R Block is going to use that in their advertising. You know, that's already kind of taken care of. The people who those memes benefit will spread them. But, you know, hey, you know, there was some accounting fraud. And, like, you know, people don't want to look at the tragedies. Here in New York, we had, I remember, it was a thing about 8 years ago, 9 years ago. There was this thing where they realized that the MTA, the people who maintain all the subways and buses in New York City, they actually had two sets of books, and they were cooking the books, and that people were, like, grifting tons of fucking money off the top. Grifting's probably not the word, but you know what I mean. They were skimming tons of money off the top.
Yeah.
And so then there was this, you know, sort of scandal, and, oh, something's got to be done about it, and that guy ended up not going to jail. Nothing fucking happened. The following year, they said, the MTA has a surplus of a few million dollars. It's great. Now we can finally start doing some work that needed to be done. So you give us, all right, forget about that bad story. Here's a good story. And then the next year, it was, the MTA is missing millions of dollars, and it turns out we're actually broke, and we need to raise the fares for everybody. So the fare for the subway, which millions of people take every day, goes up. Now, all this manipulation has a very real effect on millions of people, just so some guy can skim off the top. If there's a way to continue the meme that says, hey, look what this guy's doing, it's affecting millions of people, I do think that's probably more necessary than... I'll be honest, this is why I have a hard time with the synchronistic obsession with pop culture. Like, I get it. I get that it's as much a facet of reality as anything else. But my point is, if some guy steals $5 million from the MTA, and now everyone in New York has to pay double the fare to get on the train when you're already struggling to pay your bills every month, that has a very real effect. We can talk about the astrological significance of Katy Perry's new video, but you know what? Someone's already taking care of the fact that they're making sure that video is on every fucking, you know, it's on MTV 24 hours a day, and it's on every radio station. That meme's already being propagated. It's taken care of. Like, I do think we have to nurture some of the stories that are, dare I say, you know, don't want to make value judgments here, but dare I say, maybe more important than what Katy Perry does.
Yeah, where are we? We have built the lens that can process information to an extraordinary depth, and we can make connections and bring in other acausally connected elements to elucidate a bigger story, a more meaningful story. But why continue to hold your lens on a pop star, right? Why not just turn that channel off? Turn your gaze to other things and use your lens for that matter. And so, okay, then what? Is there only tragedy and pop stars? Is that what our world is filled with? No, not at all. But I think it can be very... There's an instant gratification, and there's an... It's sex and violence, essentially, is what is the sort of end result or the byproduct of keeping your gaze on those facets of our reality. You know, they're sink in the
sure,
forest,
yeah,
too.
I think,
right?
Yeah, I think there's just, again, it's just as much harm in being out of balance to either extreme. So the people who only are obsessed with conspiracies and political manipulation, I've done that. That'd make you fucking crazy. just because it's like, what the point I like to make is, it's like if you go into let's say you go out into the woods or you know, a park or something, and you pick up a rock, and you find some bugs and worms underneath. Then you pick up another rock and you find some bugs and worms underneath. And you keep going around. Guess what? Every rock you pick up, you look underneath something, you're going to find bugs and worms. You're going to find something crawling under there. If you go into a dark basement and you shine a flashlight into the corner, you might see something scurrying. So, you know, there's this save-the-world mentality amongst the conspiracy crowd that if we can shine a light into every corner around the world, we can stop all dark acts or all misdeeds. I don't think is true. That's actually how you end up with Big Brother.
Yeah.
It's you end up with the opposite of what you want because, well, all right, so you stopped, you know, you got David Rockefeller and the Illuminati and blah, blah, blah. And what about the guy who beats his wife in his house? How do you get that guy? Well, you better put a camera in the house. Or, do you know what I mean? Like, where do you take that step that you think you're going to eradicate evil deeds in the world?
It's like parents who have a new baby and they put that that speaker inside the room with the child.
Mm-hmm.
Every fucking parent has one. If you're not using it, you're a bad parent. But what are they really preventing? Maybe that one in a million thing happens that they can prevent. But if, I guess basically what I'm saying is, can you have that surveillance in your child's room and be against Big Brother? Can you live with those two things? Because everything's connected. Those two things are connected. I don't pretend to have an answer to it, but you have to at least respect its connection and engage in it and understand it. There should be no blind spots is really what it all comes down to.
And, you know, I mean, this is ultimately, like, it's why I feel on most days I don't get worked up about it because I feel like, well, okay, you're going to have the Kyle Hunts of the world are going to use this sort of lens that we built to look at, pedophiles in Hollywood. And Jay Kotzes of this community are going to use that lens to look at how stars' birthdays line up with what movie roles they have. And someone else, just go down the line. You know, these people are going to all look at different angles. So we built a common lens, then we use this lens to look at everything. And maybe, in that sense, you kind of cover all your territory. But I think it's nice to have that sort of like, okay, someone's taking care of the pop star's birthday tip, and someone's taking care of the, you know, pedophile rapist tip, and someone's taking care of, okay, we got all our bases covered. But I think modern medicine has shown that overly specializing in anything is detrimental, is just as detrimental as the jack of all trades, master of none. So I think this is why I have frustration. I get frustrated with the conspiracy crowd that, like, you're so focused on the conspiracy that you're letting it taint how you view everything. Like this Batman Sandy Hook map. Oh my God, okay, it's obviously planted, it's obviously this, or it's obviously sink, or it's obviously whatever. Whatever, it's your set and setting, you know? It's whatever you brought into it. If you've decided there's a master plan to control humanity, then that's what you're going to see. And if you decided that it's Jupiter's master plan to bring joy to everyone, that's what you're going to see. So we, of course, bring our biases into this stuff without realizing. And then my fear is, like, the only way to get out of that bias is to let in more points of view. This is why I feel like I have to do these think books, even though it's kind of difficult for me. Just to be honest, it's difficult for me in many ways. But I feel like you have to keep letting in more points of view. It's how you keep yourself from getting trapped in dogma or single set and setting that you have this knee-jerk reaction. Oh, this is obviously a conspiracy. Oh, it's obviously synchronicity. If you don't let in the other points of view, then it's always going to be the same thing. It's going to be self-referencing and self-confirming. If you let in other points of view, you see how it could also miss, or could be a combination of effects. So for me, like, I get frustrated with the conspiracy guys, that everything's a conspiracy. Oh, Sandy Hook's in Batman, it's gotta be a conspiracy. And then at the same time, I get frustrated with the, you know, the pop culture synchronistics, where it's like, we've built this amazing device that we look at anything and find magic in anything. Why the fuck are we looking at Katy Perry? Like, we got it. We're done. Like, I am eternally grateful to the synchronistic community for showing me this lens. I just want to, like, look at other stuff, too.
Yeah. Everything has an expiration date. Everything has an expiration date. If it doesn't, then it's plastic, right? It's a good clue to know exactly what you're dealing with. And, you know, I think we've talked about how, and this is a very kind of difficult thing to approach. Jason Barrera's posts seem to continually reiterate the same thing over and over, and he even admits to that. But I don't know if I stopped. My interest in his posts has waned because either A, I don't know if I understand it anymore, or B, I did understand it, I moved on, and there's nothing there for me anymore. Or C, I'm just jealous at what seems to be a true genius, you know? I'm conflicted by the output of a Jason Barrera. I don't know where I am with that, but that's a conversation I'd like to have, you know? I'd like to ask him more questions. I'd like to see, is there something big that I'm missing, or what is your take on these questions? That's the direction I'd like to go with this stuff. Because again, I'm more than willing to find out, oh, okay, I need to go back and read this, or I need to go back into the directions he's pointing to get more out of that. But for right now, I can't get my mind into it like I once did with a lot of the material he's put out there. And again, I don't know. I don't know if I'm alone on that or whatever, but that's just where I sit with it. And Jason Barrera is a very important mind, and I think I would be doing a disservice to this forum if I didn't express that.
I think he's hugely important, but I also, yeah, I have to admit, I have the same, it's hard because it's very, it's not only self-referencing, but it's also, I think one of the difficulties of a Mask of God post is also the lack of context for a lot of the movies. He does an amazing job mashing these movies up and showing a narrative. So, like, I think he has this amazing artistic sense of how to assemble a blog post in a new way. That, I'm stunned by his genius there. And at the same time, it's a very hard time getting into some of these posts because, all right, I see, like, here's a still from this movie which I've never seen. Oh, and then this is also a clip from a movie I've never seen, and then here's another movie I've never seen. Like, I think what appealed to me about the pop culture synchromysticism in the beginning was that it was context. If I try and explain to you a personal synchronicity, oh, you know, I was at the post office the other day, and then this woman named whatever reminded me of someone I haven't seen. It's like, I could go on and on and on about this thing, and it doesn't really convey anything to you because it's not, it's too personal. And what appealed to me about the pop culture lens was that, well, it's a common context. If I talk about 2001 A Space Odyssey, everyone's seen it 5 times. We can have that conversation, and it's a common frame of reference that we can discuss from. That was appealing to me. And then as we get into more and more obscure movies, and then more of them, like, I feel like for me to keep track of what the Sinkhole puts up, and what the Mask of God puts up, and what the Facebook page puts up, I would need to watch, like, 5 movies a day. And yeah. I can't do that. So I think that's my fear, is that, you know, it's and I think frustration is, I think we've moved to a point where rather than being helpful of having this massive common context where it's great to show how, you know, I think what the value of a Jason or a Jake is to show that you can put this lens on anything, even the most obscure movie you've never heard of, and it's still in there.
It's like the old Crowley thing where he says, you know, how to apply the Kabbalah, and he's like, you can do it with anything, and he does it with the nursery rhymes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all right there. Everything about pop culture, synchro mysticism is all right there, and that one little addendum to, I think, Book 4 by Crowley, where he does, you know, the old woman who lived in the shoe, and he breaks down the whole nursery rhyme. He's like, this is what that's about. But it's a joke. Or is it? But it puts you in the right headspace to get in contact with the kinds of ways of thinking that most of us believe are essential to going down this path, to not being a victim, you know, to choosing your own adventure, Alan.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Which is why I think I've probably, someone might think I've talked a lot of shit in this episode, but I don't mean it that way. It's like, I do respect that everyone's choosing their, you know, it would be foolish for me to say, hey, here's this lens, now I want you to, why aren't you looking at this other stuff? Yeah, choose your own adventure. You want to look, if you're fascinated with Denzel Washington or Jennifer Connelly, go for it. Go for it. I mean, that's your thing. But I think the reason it's like, it's just funny to me is like, I saw on Facebook people say like, oh, okay, I'd rather not talk about real world events because, you know, it gets into these sticky areas. Or, like you said, then there's the fascinating, like, suddenly, when I tried to bring up real world events, people say, oh, we don't want to talk real world events because it gets into, it's too slippery, like the nature of reality and all these sort of things that are involved, or people think conspiracies, so let's avoid that. And then suddenly there's a school shooting and everyone's talking about it. So like you said, there's a fascination, a morbid curiosity with tragedy. Is it just because the tragedies make it to the pop culture level? Like, you know, talking about, you know, the ambassador to Kuala Lumpur has a brain tumor isn't really that exciting, but a school shooting that's on every news channel, it's suddenly, have we elevated our tragedies to pop culture level?
It's all pornography, really. It's, you know, it's, I think for me right now, it's people have elevated the dissection and critical analysis of religion in our world and its positives and its negatives, and we can kind of, you can, for most adults, you can kind of have a rational conversation about religion, but I think the next conversation is about pornography and just how subtle and dangerous and how it has infiltrated so much of our media and so much of how we approach these things. And it's insidious, but thankfully it's out in the open. It's right in front of us. And I think that the conversation, once it gets started, will be quick and it'll be efficient and it will get to the heart of the matter. But there is something like, dude, when you were a kid, you remember Faces of Death, right?
Oh, hell yeah.
And to get to that material would require, if you were underage, you know, they wouldn't rent it to you. It was for adults only. That was sort of a rite of passage when you could finally get and rent the Faces of Death video. And it was an fairly anticlimactic affair. I mean, it was horrifying. It was not something that was good in any way. But it just represented something as a child that was out of my reach, something unattainable, something, there was a certain grail quest to it. But what was inside was horrific. Well, Faces of Death is everywhere. And it's accessible to anybody of any age. And what are the consequences of that? How is it shaping our lives? And could it possibly be a beneficial thing? Could it be a detrimental thing? It doesn't matter what the judgment is. Let's just examine it. Let's just examine if it is a major player in what's happening today. Pornography is another thing. If you wanted to watch a pornographic movie, you know, there was a room at the video store that had a fucking a door to it, or, you know, a drape to it, and you couldn't go in there unless you were 18. And that was another kind of thing. You knew it existed, you knew where it was, but it was inaccessible. Well, all this shit is accessible now.